This is MMA Torch editor Wade Keller, along with Sean Ennis and Jerry Catalane, and we are here to talk about UFC 71 that was completed last night, and I think a very good fight card. I think everybody agrees with that. Why don't we begin by talking about the main event with Quentin Rampage Jackson upsetting Chuck the Iceman Liddell in, I think, quicker fashion than anybody would have put money down on. Let's just start with you, Sean. Were you shocked by the finish? Were you blown away by the finish? What was your first reaction when you saw that right hook just land perfectly on the jaw?
You know, the finish itself didn't surprise me all that much. How quickly it came was a big surprise to me. And I think, you know, what happened with Liddell is he went in there with the same game plan as he does against lesser strikers, and that was his problem. You know, he goes in there, he hangs that left hand down, and he's got his chin out, and he's got his hands down, you know, just kind of goading the guys in to come and try and hit him. And the problem with a guy like Rampage is if he hits you, you know, you see what happens.
I bet there were people who had not watched UFC before watching this event, obviously, with all the publicity, and they hear all this hype about what a great fighter Liddell is and this winning streak. He's a center of the sport, and he goes out there and leaves his chin out there in the first 2 minutes. And they just think, that guy's got terrible technique. I thought it was kind of embarrassing for Liddell that he didn't adjust his game plan knowing how Rampage fights, and that he either was cocky or careless or stubborn, one of those three. And obviously, in retrospect, he knows it. How about you, Jerry?
Well, I thought, I agree with Sean, even though I actually went out and picked Jackson to win this.
I did, too.
I thought,
although not as officially.
I think when we talked about this in the preview podcast, that you could make the argument for Chuck not being ready to go against a guy that was a competent striker, and we kind of ran down his past opponents and agreed that, you know, can Chuck handle being hit, and what's he going to do against a guy that primarily wants to strike with him? And I thought that they commented on the broadcast that Chuck looked just very relaxed, and I almost thought he looked too relaxed, too complacent. You know, they looked at Jackson, and they said he looked nervous and whatnot. I thought Jackson looked intense. I kind of disagreed with their commentary quite a bit. I thought Chuck looked almost, I guess complacent's a great word. He just looked like he's there, and it was going to come to him regardless, that this fight was already in the bag, and it almost looked like he was thinking about where he was going after the fight. I thought with Jackson coming out and taking the center of the ring was a great statement by Jackson that I'm here to fight.
Yep.
Waving Chuck in, I think goading Chuck into coming, getting him, and I think this could have played out better for Jackson. I don't think I am surprised that it went down in the first round, of course, but this was Jackson's fight from the get go.
I think if Chuck went in and lost by changing his game plan, if he changed his game plan, fought differently and lost, I think that would be tougher for him to live with than going in and fighting his fight and losing. And at least he went in and fought his style and lost. Both are embarrassing for him, I would argue. But if he went in and totally changed his approach and lost, it would look kind of foolish, and everyone would go, why didn't you do what brought you to the dance? But also, you just don't leave your chin out there and your left hand down, so...
But he's gotten away with it in the past, though, we've seen him get away with that over and over in his last at least three or four fights because he's not getting tagged, he's not getting really hit to put him back on his heels, and Jackson showed why one of the reasons why he took Chuck out with strikes last time. He's got heavy hands and he's very quick.
Yes, and Randy Couture is now the official person I'm going with on all big fight picks.
I'm not kidding. If you're putting money down, talk to Couture.
Yes.
I think we should agree that Randy can't enter the prediction contest.
I mean, there's not a lot of fight strategy to talk about in this match because there wasn't a lot of fight. And from a bigger picture standpoint, does it hurt UFC that this is probably the most watched fight in their history, given all the hype that went into it, a lot of first-timers, and it goes down this way? And it's a short match, kind of reminiscent of Tyson in the 80s. People who didn't pay a lot of attention to the undercard and thought, well, this is going to be great. You know, there's all this talk about how great these fights are. Does it hurt UFC, or does it help that there was this stunning knockdown and this incredibly charismatic, full of energy guy who now emerged as the new king of UFC? Do both of those balance each other out, or is one a bigger deal, positive or negative, than the other?
You know, I think on the whole, it is a positive for the UFC. You know, they spent all this time on SportsCenter and on, you know, and all the media outlets building up Liddell as a killer, and they spent, you know, relatively very little time on Jackson. And now all of a sudden, everyone's going to say, well, who's this Rampage guy who's, you know, standing in the middle of the ring howling, you know, after knocking out this killer? I think, you know, it's almost a double-edged sword in that they built up Liddell like they did, and then he gets knocked out so quickly. But at the same time, you know, they made Rampage a star in a minute and 3 seconds, you know?
Yeah.
I think it kind of balances each other out. I think the shock value of seeing Chuck get taken out so quickly overrides any potential credibility issues. You know, I agree with both of you. Chuck was really built up in the run up for this fight, and I'm surprised that Jackson wasn't built up as much, given that he's such a media personality. That kind of surprised me a little bit in the pre-fight hype. But in terms of pure credibility in a first timer, I mean, it was very much a bang bang finish. That got most of the people in my house up on their feet, like, oh my gosh, look at this happen.
Yep.
And I think that overrides any, I think the negative part comes away in retrospect. And if there's a new fan out there that hadn't seen mixed martial arts before, for that fan to sit back and contemplate and say, well, you know, here's this guy that was unbeatable and he went down in less than 2 minutes, so, you know, how credible can this sport be? I'm not sure there's a whole lot of fans out there like that.
Yeah.
And I think the fans that are out there that contemplate this at length are probably the fans that will look at it and, you know, go into old fight videos and YouTube and Google and what have you and get a sense of who Quentin Jackson is. So I don't really see the downside of this at all, truly.
Yeah, and I think it also helps that the entirety of the card was, I think, a really good showcase for what MMA is all about. I thought we got a good variety of stand-up and ground fighting. I thought the last fight that they showed helped balance it out, because there might have been a little too much stand-up. All in all, there might have been a little more stand-up than is representative of a typical UFC card. But overall, there were enough good fights, good finishes, and a variety of techniques showing that I think if it was a bad card and this fight only went, you know, if this fight only went a couple minutes, I think then that would be more of a downside.
Yeah, I think this was the card for... you know, for someone that hadn't seen a lot of mixed martial arts before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, again, variety is a good word, but I think there were a lot of exciting fights, even where I think some fans who've seen earlier fights get a little turned off by the lay and pray approach. You didn't see a lot of that tonight. Even when fighters were on the ground, they were very active.
Yeah.
A lot of submission attempts. I think, Sean, we said on Friday that we didn't see many submission victories happening. Shows you what we know sometimes.
Yeah.
But I agree, it was a great card to introduce somebody new to the sport, because it was an exciting card. All the fights, I think, were pretty exciting.
You had mentioned how all the pre-fight hype had been about Chuck Liddell, and that even came across after the final prelim fight, and when Wilson Gouveia was talking about, and Rogan was talking about, Chuck Liddell, Chuck Liddell, Chuck Liddell. And you got the sense that until the fight took place, people were not assuming Chuck was for sure going to win, but at least speaking as if that was the likelihood.
Yep. I didn't see anybody that they were interviewing there actually pick Jackson. I'm not sure if that's just from an unfamiliarity with how he fights, or if Chuck is just the credible choice. But I think it speaks to Chuck's aura of invincibility that you know, once you get three or four fights in a row, or five or six, or in Chuck's case, seven, that you have this aura that you cannot be beaten. And again, we touched on this Friday. You're going to lose sometime.
Yeah. Well, in 2/3 of the online voting was, or text voting, whatever that was, went for Chuck also among all UFC viewers. But, I mean, they did a lot of talking about Chuck's record the last few years, and they didn't do a lot of talking about Rampage's record the last few years.
No.
And people, and including Chuck, probably thought he was a much better fighter than he was when he and Rampage fought before. And I think they just felt, hey, he's got a lot more experience. It's his cage, and it's his home base, and he's going to win. But obviously, with all the things that have been going on, all the upsets recently, there was no doubt in people's mind it was possible Chuck would lose. Rampage, I thought they did a great job on the show, as you guys talked about in the pregame. They did a great job on Monday's preview show, establishing that if there is a style of fighter that Chuck was susceptible to, it was Rampage.
Yeah, that was they really did do a great job on that countdown show.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely true. You know, Rampage is the only guy in the last eight fights that has stood in front of Liddell and struck him.
Right. Yeah, and you know what? There was so much money on the line for Rampage. Chuck's made good money, and he's going to make even more good money,
right,
win or lose. But for Rampage, this is a it wasn't a $5 million fight for this fight, but it's $5 million difference in his next few years, because that win, even if he doesn't win again in UFC, buys him 3, 4, 5 big money fights against other fighters, because now that he beat Chuck, it's going to mean something to beat him, even if he loses the next two.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think that was a big part of the motivation. And Jackson, again, he's such a media figure. This is the perfect time for something like Quentin Jackson to become, you know, the face of the UFC. I think $5 million is a little low. I think if he wins a fight or two, you're looking at a guy that I think is truly a crossover sort of star. I would like to see perhaps a little less profanity out of most of the fighters last night, quite honestly.
Yeah.
Not that, you know, I mean, anybody who knows me personally knows that bleep and bloop are two of my favorite words. But
well, then you must love Dana White on The Ultimate Fighter.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, he's more beeps than actually speaking.
Well, and you know, I mean, I understand the culture, like I say. I mean, it's certainly one thing, but I think, you know, like I said, Quentin is primed to become a big-time crossover star. The sky is absolutely the limit for him. That was one of my little pet peeves with the show last night. There were too many, you know, mother bleeper this and mother bleeper that. If you're gonna expand the fan base into the other demographics, you're gonna have to kind of watch that.
Well, and also, I mean, Dana White just lectured the guys on Ultimate Fighter this last week,
mm-hmm,
about representing the sport,
right,
and doing it well, and that was because they got in a drunken fight in the backyard.
Right.
But you know, you're making a good point, which is, what about all the swearing? I mean, why further the stereotype that you're just a bunch of foul-mouthed punks? I mean, I think you don't want to come across as if you're trying to be G-rated, because frankly, it is a fight sport and it is,
yep,
testosterone-laced. But I do think that there's a happy medium, and when it seems like everyone's trying to one up each other, and you know, there's a point there.
It seemed very gratuitous.
Yeah,
it really did. And again, it's not, like I said, I don't want to make this whole tangent go too far, but when the fight card was over last night, and you know, we flipped over to ESPN where they kind of broke in with the coverage, it reminded me of the big time pay per view fights maybe 10-15 years ago, which for some of our listeners may not recall, but back then you'd get the still pictures of the fight,
yeah,
just on the pay per view, and it would give you a sense of a real event. And so when the mainstream media is starting to treat this like a real big time sports event, which it is certainly starting to do, I think that's where you have to start minding your P's and Q's a little bit.
Yeah,
you bring up a good point with the old big time fights, you know, the boxing matches that were on SportsCenter and whatnot.
Yeah.
With the still pictures, I think they really said a lot that they actually had footage,
yeah,
of the fights. You know, I think that's really important for them to get that footage out there. You know, it's dangerous in a pay per view type atmosphere to make yourself inaccessible, and to get that footage on the free television is really important for them.
Well, with
I agree.
I think with the Tyson fights, the reason they showed still pictures is they're charging $50, and the whole point was to see Tyson swing that one punch that knocked his guy down. And if you knew you were going to be able to see it on ESPN, you might forego the $50 because you didn't care about the undercard, and you knew the fight was probably going to last 30 seconds. But with USC, it is 3 hours of entertainment, and frankly, they're not in a position, because they are new, to tell ESPN, nah, just go with the still shots. I think it's smarter for them to put the video up. But there might come a point where they might want to pull back on that and make people pay to see the knockout punch or the tap out.
I don't think it hurts them at all to show that, because again, let's say hypothetically you see that replay and you get a certain percentage of people that say, you know, let's buy the replay of that card and watch it. And what you'll see are, in this case, 7 good fights.
Yeah. Which of course is
7 fights, and it'll bring you back again.
Go ahead, Sean.
The other thing of note on SportsCenter was that the anchor also mentioned the Jardine-Alexander fight without showing the actual footage.
Yeah.
Well,
I was gonna say,
I wonder how many people at ESPN actually watched anything more than the highlight clip.
Oh, yeah, the vast majority, I'm sure, didn't watch anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
also, there are a lot of reasons that potentially could be, I suppose. I think you can't expect it to become completely mainstream overnight. I think there's a huge step as they go into the summer. I mean, keep in mind, this is Memorial Day weekend. Got another huge holiday weekend coming up with the stacked card in July, and I think they're going to build momentum. That card will go through the roof.
Yep. They have so many just great fights set up right now between all the upsets, which in and of themselves create good rematches and new matchups you didn't expect, and then the signing of a number of new big names. So, I mean, they're just absolutely set. If they had a pay-per-view once every 2 weeks for the next 4 months, I think that they could have two headline matches on each pay-per-view. That would, I mean, maybe that's pushing it, but I bet they could probably come close to pulling that off for, you know, just doing 8 shows in the next 4 months.
Yeah, they probably could. I mean, I think if you go through each division like we're going through looking at trying to rank the fighters now, it's a mess.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a mess, and they're all starting to come under the same umbrella. I mean, you could easily probably handle that schedule, and it would be good stuff all the way around.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a good thing for the division to be a mess, you know? At least you've got your top 2-3 guys, and then everything else, you're like, what's going to happen? You know, you've got these guys that you never know what's going to happen with these guys.
All right, Sean, start with you. Who would you name the 3 to 5 fighters you'd most like to see Jackson defend against if he gets a winning streak going and he just has to go one at a time through each of his top contenders?
Let's see. Well, if you got 3 to 5, I think you got to put, if Evans beats Ortiz, you got to put Evans in there. A little bit down the road, maybe. Dan Henderson, for sure, you know, he's going to be the next guy anyway.
Yep. But
that's definitely a big fight because they haven't even fought before. Then you've got Shogun coming over from Pride, who holds a win over Jackson, so you got the intrigue there.
Liddell, obviously.
You know, had Jardine actually won tonight or last night, I think that would have been a really intriguing fight, too.
Yep.
I think you got to toss Wanderlei Silva into that mix. You can say what you want. You know, I mean, I think we'd all probably agree that Wanderlei is not the fighter he has been, or at least needs a little time to recover to regain his former status. But here's a guy that, if I'm not mistaken, has 2 wins over Jackson already.
Yep.
And, you know, the long-time rumored foil for Liddell. And I think, to me, I mean, Henderson's a good first matchup for Jackson, and I think that's a I think that's a great fight.
The downside for UFC is if Jackson loses, you hurt the aura of somebody, and it's going to happen, so there's no turning back now, and Henderson deserves it. But Jackson's such a good spokesman for the company, such a good guy to head up the company, you'd almost want to take advantage of all the Liddell hype and get a rematch between those two in first. Because you lose the marquee value of a rematch if Jackson loses to Henderson, then that kind of throws things off, too. But it's going to be Henderson Rampage, so I think then a Liddell Silva matchup to earn a title shot would be a good way for Liddell to reprove himself and march through somebody credible.
I'll tell you that. That was going to be
my next point. Is that, you know, it's now is the perfect time for Liddell Silva. You know, it had lost its luster a little while ago, but now that Liddell is you know, mortal again, and Silva is mortal again, and both of them are trying to work their way back up. My gosh, I mean, the timing is perfect right now.
Right. Then you got to figure in, like I say, you got to figure in where are you going to put Shogun Rua.
Yep.
And also, I mean, if we're talking about, you know, Super Bowl sort of events and Pride fighters fighting UFC, I think you have to put Ramon Sokoju in there somewhere. He's beat 2 top 10 fighters already in Pride, dominantly. And this guy, I think you got to look at this guy getting in the mix here after some of the... Let's say you have a Liddell Silva matchup. After that dust clears a little bit, I think he's got to be right up there in line.
And you have a drawing card in Tito Ortiz, who you're not ready to give him a title shot, but you put him in the mix with some of these guys.
Who?
Yeah, I know.
Well, it's funny. You mentioned Tito Ortiz. I was going to make this point a minute ago. When Tito lost to Chuck again for the second time, nobody figured Tito would ever get a shot again as long as Chuck was champion. And I guess you have to look, here's Chuck now, he's lost twice to Jackson.
Yeah.
Does his run at champion get him another rematch immediately against the guy that's already beat him twice? And I mean, I think there's at least one or two fights for Chuck to get back to the title hunt again.
I think Chuck and Tito are in a different category because Chuck won 7 in a row and was the reigning champion, and Tito, you know, didn't have that kind of record going into his losses to Chuck.
I'm not trying to make them equivalent by any stretch. stretch in terms of in-octagon performance. But out of the octagon, media-friendly-wise, hype-wise, Tito Ortiz is a magnet.
Yep.
Chuck is, like I said, fine. Chuck's a nice guy that I'd want to go have a beer or two with.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want him on, you know, doing a tour of radio shows or TV shows when you have other guys in the division who are clearly more suited for it.
Yeah. Any final comments on Liddell Rampage from either of you or the division itself, or should we move on to the rest of the fight card?
I think we hit it pretty well. We can move on now.
Shame on you, Sean, for not going with your gut and picking Jackson.
I know. See, I made the argument for you in the other podcast, and then I go with Liddell. I'm telling you. Tragic.
All right, let's go ahead and just work our way through the card, the rest of the card in order here, and begin with Chris Lieben against Caleb Starnes. Sean, why don't you start us out on this one? What stood out in this fight?
It was a good opening fight. As far as jerking the curtain, getting everybody ready for the rest of the card. The thing that stood out to me is Lieben didn't seem like himself. To me, he seemed a little bit slower, maybe a little bit off his game. He had Starnes in trouble with that liver kick and never really capitalized on it, just took him to the ground. Starnes was done. He had that look on his face, the same look he got on The Ultimate Fighter when he got injured and had to quit the fight. And I thought he was just finished. But Lieben never really capitalized. He seemed a little bit out of it to me. I don't know.
Well, even the announcer said they didn't think he realized he hurt him as bad as he did.
Yeah.
He was the only one then. Because our house groaned when he hit that kick. Mm-hmm. And I could see Lieben kind of just jumping in there and finishing it right there. I thought Lieben kind of looked like a parody of himself in that he was too wild and too uncontrolled and too undisciplined. And I think that cost him a lot of the fight, because I thought Caleb hung in there pretty well. And even when he had that look on his face after getting caught with that shot, and that looked like it hurt. When he realized he could kind of hang on to Chris, and Chris wasn't really advancing position on him, I think he realized that I can still win this fight.
Yeah.
And I thought Starnes showed me something. I was fairly impressed with his performance, quite honestly.
Do you think that both guys look like they got winded a little sooner than they should have? I mean, midway through the second round, they were fighting like it was in round four.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
I touched on this with Sean a couple times too. I don't train. I'm not a professional fighter, but I would think that you don't really see. I'm going to make the boxing analogy. You don't really see boxers gas in the eighth or ninth round or tenth round, late rounds of their fights. Necessarily, it seems like fighters should be well trained to understand they're going through three long 5-minute aggressive rounds, and your training would account for that. That surprised me.
Yeah, me too. And I think even with the win, I think it was a small step back or a small setback because of that.
Yeah.
For both guys. Win or lose, both guys were not impressive enough to I think impress Dana White for that.
No, yeah, I agree. Not with the competition that's flying in from practically everywhere into the divisions. I thought that was kind of a lackluster performance. I think it hurts Lieben a ton. I think that is a tough loss for Lieben.
Yeah. All right, match number two, we had if you're a casual fan watching this and you don't know a lot about the fighters going in, UFC does a great job in a minute and a half between the soundbite promo clips and a little pre-match video, and then as the fighters walk to the ring, I think Rogan and Goldberg do a really nice job setting up the backstory. And the backstory to this was Jardine was insulted by having to have this fight. And so you basically set up going, how quickly and decisively is Keith Jardine going to win this fight, because he's so upset he has to fight this nobody, Houston Alexander. But Houston Alexander's not a nobody because he's lost a bunch of big fights in UFC before. He's considered an unknown because he hasn't been in UFC before. He hasn't been tested, and that's the most dangerous kind of fighter to be cocky against. And so from a storyline perspective, it just absolutely played out in the most dramatic way an undercard match can, which is a major upset against a guy who thought he had a cakewalk. So that was just one of those fun moments that, again, for a lot of casual UFC fans, and I was trying to watch this through their eyes a little bit, this was a lot of fun because UFC made you care about the fight, even if you didn't know who both of the guys were and didn't know how close Jardine was to earning a title shot.
Yep. I can't agree with you enough. I mean, it was if he had won the fight, period, it's a major upset. To win it in dominating fashion.
Yep.
I had a couple house guests for the show, and as the resident expert in quotes, we were talking through the fight card, and like I said, a couple of them are on a podcast, and I don't think Sean or I gave Alexander, you know, a snowball's chance in Hades to win this fight. And so Jardine comes out and actually gets a good shot on him, and I think that's where he got a little too overconfident.
Yeah.
Because he got the first shot in, he had him in a position where I thought he was going to do some damage, and all of a sudden, Alexander backs him up against the cage and starts throwing uppercuts, and those were bombs. I mean, those were just devastating shots.
And it was just over. Yeah,
I
thought Jardine was too surprised with how quickly Alexander recovered. You know, I mean, regardless of whether he's been in the UFC or not, he's a professional fighter. You don't know anything about this guy. I mean, yeah, he dropped him, but he got right back up and gets him in the clinch. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jardine leaves himself open and gets just hammered, you know.
And, I mean, and Houston had, and what'd they say, 5 of his 6 wins coming into UFC had come by stoppage or submission. You know, it's not like this is the guy who doesn't have a reputation for putting up a fight. I love the camera shot of Keith Jardine. UFC usually does a great job with getting fighter reactions afterwards, especially when they're starting to come to and they're being told by their corner what happened because they don't remember. And I have that. That's one of the most vivid memories of the show was the close-up of Keith Jardine just looking down, shaking his head, going, "What happened?
What happened?" Yeah.
And then they explain it to him, and he's just in disbelief that could possibly happen. And because he knows what he said going into the fight, so he set himself up perfectly as a you know a cocky jerk who, you know that's how he allowed himself to be portrayed, who got shown up.
Yep.
So is Houston for real? I mean, how much do you guys know about him other than this fight? Is he someone that
right now he just knocked out our number 5 or 6th ranked fighter in less than a minute.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I know nothing about him other than I mean, it looked. I tell you, he can take a punch and he can certainly throw him. And as we've seen, that makes you about as for real as anybody right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this will be the last time anyone openly disses him before a fight.
He looks good. I mean, you gotta admit, a lot of these times you see these fighters and you don't see them before the fight or you don't see clips of them. You know, Alexander looked like a world killer.
He
looked ripped for this fight. He looked ready. I mean, he had the intense look. He had maybe, 2% body fat? I mean, he looked ready.
It's funny because you see guys like that and you wonder, are they, are they going to be like that, like Houston Alexander was last night, or are they going to be, Kevin Randleman, something like that.
Yeah.
He was definitely, I mean, he definitely looked the part, and he told Jardine what he thought after the fight, too.
Yes, his reaction to the win was just great. I mean, that was a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, that was amazing.
All right, now we have Ivan Salivary against Terry Martin. Jerry, why don't you start us off on this one?
Terry Martin fan. I was looking forward to this fight because I thought this was one we talked about quite a bit on Friday, and there were so many scenarios we could see this playing out. I thought I was actually pretty impressed with Salivary's style, and I thought he was really hurting Martin with the kicks if he could have stayed away from Martin a little longer. But I thought Martin showed a lot of boot strength and just trying to shake. It reminded me of when he was shaking Salivary around, trying to get the takedown, trying to get the throw, of kind of how a dog plays with a chew toy. I just say, trying to pick up and shake him one way and then move him the other way, and I thought his strength was really imposing there. I know there was a lot of controversy about an early stoppage. I didn't think it was early at all. Salivary looked out. I mean, he may not have been, but he certainly looked limp when he went down and he caught a couple of those shots, so I didn't have a problem with the stoppage at all. I would like to see Salivary fight again, though.
Yeah.
Salivary is an exciting fighter when he gets in there and can play his game. You know, I mean, it was a pretty interesting fight for as long as it lasted. You know, you had, moving counter, Salivary's throwing these leg kicks, so Martin comes in closer on him and clinches. And he's looking for the throw, so Salivary's countering the throw and he's going for a standing Kimura. And, ironically enough, that's what ended up being his demise. He couldn't get his hands up to stop his head from hitting that mat. And, all you got to do is be out for a couple seconds, and that's enough to stop the fight.
And I think the ref might have – I agree it was closer to an early stoppage than a late stoppage. I mean, I think that was pretty clear. But when a guy gets thrown onto his head and it gets contorted to the side, and then he takes a blow after that, The ref doesn't have the benefit of seeing replays. He doesn't know if he really did hurt his neck or his head. And, you know, it's tough to argue with the ref's decision because he did get tossed onto his head. It wasn't just the, you know, what happened after that, so.
Yeah. Wait, I think probably the injury in question, just the way he went down, looked to me like, at the time of the event, that he probably either had a broken collarbone or a separated shoulder, one or the other.
Yeah.
Because you could just see just the way he went down into the mat. And for anybody that's kind of had that injury in football or hockey or mixed martial arts, it kind of makes your arm feel heavy and painful to move, and it does not put you in a good position to defend yourself.
No, no. Any other comments on this fight? I mean, there wasn't a ton to it, so.
I like Martin's chances in this division. I really do. I think, if I'm not mistaken, he was calling out Anderson Silva after the fight.
Yep.
And I watched that fight. I think I like Martin's chances to move up. I really do. I think he's got heavy hands. He's physically strong for the division, and he seems like a fighter that can develop a good game plan. Salivary is no slouch, and he fought a good game plan against Salivary.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, I think a good next fight for Martin might be maybe Martin Kamen.
Yeah, that'd be a good matchup.
All right, let's move on to what a lot of people thought would be the fight of the night, and it didn't disappoint. wasn't an all time. I don't think it was fight of the year contender, but it was a very good fight. Josh Burtman and Carol Parisian.
Yeah.
Jerry, why don't you start us off on this one again?
I agree. I think a lot of people expected this to be the fight of the night, and I think it was. Aside from the pure excitement moments of the Alexander knockout and Jackson winning the title. From bell to bell, this was a solid fight. I think that Carl really did his reputation a lot of good. Berkman stood in there and took a lot of shots, didn't really back down, went right at Carl, and Parisian just showed his game. And it's hard not to see Carl getting a shot sooner rather than later, especially with the proclamations he kind of made afterwards. And I can't blame this guy. I mean, you know, it's hard to watch guys go by you and get their shots when you didn't do anything really to miss your shot in the first place except get injured. But I give credit to Berkman. He showed quite a bit. I thought he fought a real good fight against a guy who's probably at least top five in the division.
Yeah.
And Josh, I think Josh has got to take this experience and move on. I don't think this loss really hurts him in any way. I think there's any. Actually, you could make the argument Kyle can beat anybody in the division. I wasn't a big fan of Berkman necessarily before the fight, but I like his style. I thought he fought a great fight, a good, courageous fight. I'd like to see him fight several more times. I think the future is real bright for him.
You know, the only thing that stood out to me with Berkman as a negative was it was kind of like the first fight. I thought he seemed a little more tired than he should have been by the middle of round two.
Yeah, I thought he was getting hit quite a bit. That had a lot to do with that.
And I think
grappling in with Caro, I would imagine, is kind of a... I would think that saps you. I mean, they kept alluding to his nickname, the Heat, several times. And I think the reason why you saw Berkman a little more gassed and tired towards the back of the second round and into the third is just because he was getting hit and he was getting pushed around.
Did you have the first round going to Carl?
Me personally, I did.
Yeah. Do you agree it was close?
I would, but I thought it was enough for Carl to have the round.
Yeah. Yeah.
What backed that up was in the second round, he built on what he did in the first round.
Yes.
And then moved along.
Yeah. Bergman's corner told him going into the third round he had to finish in this round, that he couldn't throw the decision. So, Sean?
Yeah, I thought it was just a fantastic... The first round was just excellent. I mean, if they were able to keep that pace up for all three rounds, I think you got a fight of the year candidate. But, you know, Caro, they fucked up all night that he's called the Heat, and then that's for a reason, and it certainly is. I mean, the guy, he's such a joy to watch, you know, for a fight fan. He gets his game, and he goes in there, and he just executes it. You know, and he's not all about offense. He goes in there, and he was defending really well. He wasn't just putting his hands up, but he's completely dodging these punches by Berkman. And Berkman's just winging them, and he's, you know, he's getting out of the way. And he's getting in there, getting his judo throws, and it's just so exciting to watch. And Carl was, the guy's 24 years old, you know.
That stunned me.
Yeah, he's going to be around forever, you know, and I think the UFC is real lucky to have him.
On the Countdown show, I think they portrayed Carl as somebody who didn't train as seriously as he should have and was relying on his natural skills a little bit in the past. And maybe that was a maturity issue or something like that. I didn't get the sense in this fight he wasn't. that he was anything but completely prepared.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that probably was true to a certain extent before. I think the Sanchez fight was a wake-up call for him.
Yeah.
You know, because the only reason he lost that fight, or at least a big contributing factor, was the fact that he gassed in the third round and Diego dominated him. But he did not gas here, and he just, you know, just took Berkman to school.
Yep. Yeah, I'm trying to think who would be ahead of him in line once Hughes and Sarah and St. Pierre kind of settle their situation.
Fitch
and Koscheck and Parisian.
I'm not sure, but I would think Fitch and Kyle have a place ahead of Koscheck. I really would.
Yeah, I would think you get an eliminator fight between Caro and Fitch, and I think that would be great.
Because I think you'll see St. Pierre run over Koscheck. I think a Fitch Parisian fight is a shot for a shot, you might say.
Yeah, I could see that. And obviously, there's Diego and BJ. Just looking at the MMA Torch rankings. You know, so it's some good intriguing matchups. Again, I mean, that's where you can make the case. They can put intriguing matches on either fight nights or pay-per-views every 2 weeks for the next 4 months and be in good shape.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have John Fitch coming up on, I think, is he on the Ultimate Fight Night coming up, or is he on 72? I forget off the top of my head, but that's a must-win fight.
Yeah.
That is a must-win fight for John Fitch. I mean, that is probably one of his, that's probably going to be, I think that's the next-to-last fight on the card, and that is a fight he's got to win in a dominating fashion, or at least, you know, proving that he deserves a shot to be in that discussion, because up till now, the casual fans probably had a hard time seeing John Fitch fight, but he's a solid all-around fighter that belongs right there in that mix that you just never seem to hear about.
Yeah, you're right. The UFC is putting Fitch in dangerous fights because, you know, he's winning all fights, but he can't lose to these guys that have very little name recognition. You know, he can't lose to a Rowan Carnero, because the next guy that he's fighting. You know, it's one thing to lose to Caro Parisian. It's another one to win five in a row, but then lose to a no-name.
Right. Well, because the loss hurts you immeasurably.
Yeah.
And then we got two good prelim fights, which was nice to have time for those. Dean Thomas and Jeremy Stephens. Sean, why don't you start us off on this one?
Well, Dean Thomas, what show he put on last night. And you know, the big thing that stood out to me in the pre-fight interview, if you contrast it with Jardine, because they're both fighting guys that are coming into the UFC for the first time, Jardine was of the opinion of, boy, it's too bad for me that I got to fight this guy, whereas Thomas gets in there and says, it's too bad for him that he's got to fight me. You know, and then Dean just went in there and just took him apart. Now Stevens, for his to speak for him, he put on a pretty impressive show. You know, he's 21 years old and he gets in there and he was hanging with Thomas on the feet, but Dean slapped that armbar on there. It didn't matter if he tapped or not.
Irrelevant.
Yeah, it was at that point.
His arm was going to be in half. So
yes, and you know, it's hard to make a case you weren't tapping when the camera shows your face. When you look like, you know, you're being tortured, you know, he wasn't in a position to get out of that. I thought at the end of round one, Dean did what so few fighters do when it's near the end of a round, which is take advantage of the last few seconds and go for broke. And I love that. I thought that was so good when he got up, and he just absolutely made sure that he was going to get that round.
Yeah. Stevens invited him up, and he said, okay, sure. Sorry.
I'm going to give Stevens a little more credit here. I thought he fought a real good fight, actually, against a guy that is known for being a tough guy to strike with because of his jab. And I thought Stevens fought a pretty good fight, and I think he just got a little careless at the end and a little too over-aggressive, and he paid for it. Because originally, I saw, you know, standing in the guard a couple times, he landed a couple good shots, scoring shots. I think this kid's going to hang around, and we'll see him again coming up on a fight night or some such.
Yep.
Because I think he's got the aggression and the ability that he'll, you know, he's only, like you said, he's only 21. He's going to get a lot better, and I think this kid's going to be, you know, certainly somebody that with a little bit of training and polishing, and probably maybe an opponent that suits him a little better, is going to put on some exciting fights.
Well, you talk about we talk about Lieben and Starnes. You know, no matter who won, it was kind of a losing fight for both as far as, you know, their positioning in the future. I think this, you're right. For Stevens, he lost, but he won.
Yeah,
absolutely. I don't mean to downplay Stevens, because he did go out there and put on a heck of an effort.
But it was, to me, it was the Dean Thomas show, really. I mean, he went out there and just showed what he can do.
Yeah, just the versatility.
And, you know, he was impressive in the first round at how calm he stayed when he was being beaten up from behind by a 21-year-old nobody. And I just thought he really showed calmness and maturity in that ring that was better than... I mean, it shows that he's been around forever, and he's been there before.
Yeah, and even for guys that have been around forever. I mean, if you go back and look at that, the Pulver-Lozon fight, Pulver started panicking when Lozon came at him, you know?
Yep.
And that's part of what lost him that fight.
Yeah, that's a good point, Sean. That's a really good point.
All right, then we had the bonus fight at the end, which I was very glad they showed. Wilson Gouveia and Carmelo Marrero. Jerry, why don't you start us off on this one? A good fight to end with. It wasn't the best fight of the night, but I thought it showed a nice submission finish on a show that was mostly stand-up.
Yep, I agree. It could have been a sloppy fight because by the time this one came out, I don't think any of us were expecting another fight to come out after the Jackson fight. I think they had about half an hour of interview time left.
Yep.
When this one started, and I could just see, you know, going to the slow burn with Rogan and Goldberg and, you know, kind of burning 15 minutes there and signing off. So it was really, really nice for the UFC to throw this fight in there. I think they wanted to showcase Gouveia a little bit. And he just outclassed Marrero, just a better fighter.
Yep.
Standing up and going to the ground. And, it was nice because, again, the way Rogan and Goldberg called the action in the first fight, they kind of talked you right through exactly what Gouveia was doing, and Gouveia did it. locked in the choke, and that was it. But a great dominating performance by Gouveia. That was interesting with the post-fight interview with Rogan when he's going, you know, he was rooting for Chuck, and it's kind of weird to see those things after the main event's already happened.
Yeah,
it's good for a chuckle or two sometimes.
Is he a contender to face Chuck, or do you have to put Chuck in there with a bigger name fighter?
Gouveia?
Yeah.
It's Chuck Liddell. I mean, you know, Chuck has been the champion for a long time, so he's been fighting the top guys, you know, in the division. It may not be a bad idea to throw him somebody a little lower down on the ladder. The risk, of course, is that if Gouveia wins,
yeah,
it really takes a lot out of Chuck's medal. So I think one of the problems you might run into in MMA, especially when you have a dominant champion or even a champion that's made a couple defenses and is a known quantity, is MMA is so unpredictable that I don't think you can really risk your name guys by throwing them against somebody relatively unknown.
Yep.
Gouveia is going to be a contender, you know, as he moves up the ladder, and he's got a great skill set. I don't think I'd throw him into the Chuck Liddell deep end of the pool yet, but, you know, I think I wouldn't put Gouveia there yet. If Chuck declines, it comes down the downside, it might be a stepping stone for Gouveia to get towards the title. But I don't see Chuck fighting him now. I think Chuck's got to fight the Namer guys, especially with the names coming into the UFC that you have.
Maybe you throw Tito at him.
Yeah, I think you could. You throw Tito Ortiz at him.
Yeah.
I mean, Tito Ortiz all of a sudden has become the new light heavyweight gatekeeper.
Yep. And you know what? Tito's young enough where it's possible he can get a couple wins, and all of a sudden, you know, as some of the other guys age out, not that Rampage is going to age out before him, and Rashad Evans is going to age out before him. But, you know, Tito was kind of the way he marketed himself was, well, Chuck's going to have to retire someday, and I'm next.
Well, that's a good argument until you run into the fact that I think Jackson's 28, Rua is, isn't Rua like 25?
Well, but he was saying this before the Pride buyout.
Oh, no, I understand that. Well, no, that's a good point, but I think, even if you take the Pride guys out of it, you do have the Rashad Evanses and the Mike Bispings and those sort of fighters that are behind Tito in age, and Tito's going to be one aging as these guys grow up.
Yeah.
I don't know what Tito's going to have to do to get back to a good title shot, quite honestly.
Even a Forrest Griffin-Gouveia fight might be fun.
I think that'd be a riot.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think that might be a good matchup. You know,
maybe a good fight night headliner.
Yeah, definitely. I think Gouveia is definitely taking steps towards being on the main card again. And you know, as for Marrero, Jerry, you and I talked about this a little bit on Friday. I don't think Marrero is ready for the UFC right now. I mean, I think he got a good matchup with Chuck Congo at heavyweight, where, you know, he's going to be able to take him down at will. But he's not ready for a guy that has any kind of tools on the ground. The way he was going in for those takedowns was just completely sloppy.
Yep.
You know, he puts his head down and starts charging like a bull or something, like he's going to grab Gouveia by the chest and swing him around or something. But, Gouveia just took care of him just like Gonzaga did at heavyweight.
Yep.
Yeah, same fight. I mean, I agree with you completely. I think if there was a minor league system, Marrero needs to head to the bushes and get trained up, because again, it is getting more competitive on the pay-per-view cards. I don't think you can go in there with anything less than a full skill set and compete.
Sure.
Otherwise, you're gonna get shown up.
Yeah. At the same time, though, you know, it's a good thing for Marrero or for Gouveia. You know, you almost have to have these showcase fights every now and then. You know, you may want to get great matchups every time you see a fight, but you know, there's something to be said for building guys up. You know, feed Marrero to Gouveia. Why not? You know.
On the undercard, sure. I mean, the undercard is where these showcase fights are. I mean, there are probably more people that watched Wilson Gouveia last night. I mean, it was right on after the Jackson fight. There wasn't a whole lot of time in between the fights when they threw that up. So, I mean, it was, if you're watching the Jackson fight, you were still buzzing from that. And, oh, hey, another fight. Great.
Yeah.
And, oh, who's this, you know, and Gouveia comes out and dominates him. And it's like, oh, who's this Gouveia guy? So, I thought it was, I mean, I think one of the biggest winners of the night probably last night was Wilson Gouveia.
Yeah. And he showed, again, you know, I mean, UFC is about making money. It's about marketing. And not first and foremost, because they lose credibility, and that's important. But it does play into it. And when you got a guy like what Wilson Gouveia showed in terms of the way he called out Liddell afterwards, I mean, that's attractive to Dana White.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. But I definitely agree. I think, and also he came across as kind of a likable sort of guy.
Yep. How about... How about Dean's challenge?
I was just going to bring that up. But speaking of that, I think he probably scored some points with Dana there too.
Yep.
And I tell you what, if you're going to throw those boxers in with somebody that's going to take him out in a couple seconds, Dean Thomas is one of the guys that could do it.
Right.
I mean, just the way he shot in for that first takedown. You know, he fakes a punch and then goes in and grabs the legs. And you know, you do that to a boxer that has a little bit of takedown experience, and he's finished. You know?
Yeah. What boxer would stand a chance against Gouveia's leg kicks?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I looked at that, and I just thought there's absolutely... Put Gouveia in against any boxer, and I honestly, I mean, maybe I'm naive to boxing's ability to somehow magically leapfrog that kick or avoid it, but, I mean, you look at that, and you realize what a complete sport UFC is, and that's one of those moments where I was waiting for Rogan to jump in and say something like that, and go, you know, those leg kicks are devastating. There's not a boxer who could stand in there against that.
I think that's picking a fight that you don't need to fight.
I think
MMA is in the situation right now where the product speaks for itself, and you don't need some, you know, moronic commentator heckling you and bringing up the old John McCain term, which I'm not going to use here.
Because
it's overblown. It's a 10-year-old term. I mean, either we're going to move ahead or we're not. I mean, it's an old term offered by a man who I think has retracted it since. I think you have the product speak for itself.
I cringed when Rogan brought it up on the ESPN news or the ESPN preview show interview, where he even used that terminology when referencing what it used to be called. I just think you're right. It's a term that needs to be retired. McCain embarrassed himself during that whole process.
Yep.
You know, out of every 10 points he made, on four of them he was semi-educated, and on two of the 10 he was right, and some changes have been made, but it was so overblown, it was so pro-boxing, and completely naive to it, and what's scary is there's still people out there saying the same thing now who have never seen UFC and think it's some, even Mayweather's comments about, you know, well, they're people who couldn't cut it in boxing. It's like, what?
Yeah, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard, you know?
Yeah.
Like a wrestler comes up and wrestles in the Olympics and then says, I'm going to go be a boxer. Oh, wait, I can't cut in boxing.
I know.
Well, and again, this is coming from Floyd Mayweather. I mean,
yeah.
We're not, you know, I mean, you can't mistake somebody who's, you know, a great boxer for somebody who is philosophically wise.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't work that way. And again, I mean, anytime you use any real situation, when somebody comments on something they've never seen, witnessed, or experienced, how credible can you take that?
Well, let me take a pro boxing side. What's someone who went into that show wanting to defend boxing, and they look at the star and the centerpiece of this sport, Chuck Liddell, stand out there and leave his chin out there for Rampage, and what would they think of Rampage's boxing skills based on what they showed in that fight.
Yeah, you know, that's something I thought about when I was watching that. You know, even before Chuck got knocked out, I'm thinking, you know, if people were watching this coming off of that rope and the Bella debate from the day before, they're seeing Chuck Liddell hanging his chin out and having his hands down, and this guy would never make it in boxing, and he's one of the stand-up monsters in the UFC.
Yeah.
I don't think there's ever been an argument that Chuck would make it in boxing. That's just the thing. I mean,
yeah.
It's not about can Chuck box.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you're a pro boxing person that had the curiosity to look into the sport and watch the card honestly last night,
yeah.
As you pointed out earlier, you saw all of the variety of MMA and how it's not just boxing. Yes,
yeah.
Compared to a boxer, Chuck, who is a monster striker and a monster stand-up guy, has probably, for a professional elite boxer, has poor boxing skills. But he's got great takedown defense.
That's the key. Yep.
Strong leg kicks, and he's got heavy hands.
And then that is a key, the strong takedown defense and the fact that he obviously isn't helpless on the ground. And the fact is, if Chuck was in there against a boxer, he'd probably take the boxer down.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
you would play to your strength, and the gap between Chuck's stand-up skills being less than the boxer in his ground skills being dominant, he would go, even though it's not his strength against a normal MMA guy, he would go towards one of his weaker games because the gap would be so great. And he would just pummel him on the ground, where a boxer isn't used to that.
Yeah, and the other fact is, you know, there's a difference between, you know, pure boxing and the striking in MMA. You know, I mean, against a lot of guys, you can afford to drop your hands. You know, obviously, Chuck did it for 7 straight fights and knocked everybody out.
Yeah.
You know, you can afford to do certain things that you can't do in boxing.
Well, but plus, you've got to be in a different stance to defend leg kicks. You've got to be in a different stance in order to quickly defend against a takedown. It's a different fight, and you're looking for different things. The box, when you box, and boxing, it's not that boxing isn't a great sport. It can be a great sport, but it's not realistic fighting. And I thought Rogan did a great job explaining that as a boxing historian who loves and has loved boxing in the past. But when you're boxing, you don't have to worry about 19 out of 20 things that someone in an MMA fight has to worry about.
Right, exactly. I think the other thing that might be skipped over here a little bit is, you know, boxing and MMA are two really entirely different disciplines. And I think when you look at boxing fan and MMA fan, it almost seems to me like that this is more of a generational issue.
Oh, it is. Statistically, that's
true. And I think that you're not going to convince the other side that yours is better or yours is even credible necessarily anymore, because I think both sides can make the same argument, or would anyway, because to me, you know, I wouldn't say boxing isn't credible, but it's certainly suspect.
Yeah, well, even if you look at that debate on Friday between Rogan and DiBella, you know, that shows you the generational gap right there. I mean, DiBella walked out of the stereotype handbook for a boxing analyst.
Boy, did he ever.
Rogan, in the meantime, is, you know, the representative of the younger generation, got a big tattoo sleeve, you know, the host of Fear Factor, all that kind of stuff, and comes and talks about MMA. And that, you know, that's a pictorial right there of what the argument is.
I thought ESPN looked good and bad this week. Mostly bad. They're good because they are smart enough to jump on the bandwagon now and not be completely antiquated and way, way behind. But they look bad because even last night after SportsCenter, here's the, you know, what do they have to do with their evening other than maybe watch the biggest sporting event this weekend, arguably, or certainly top two? What do they have better to do if your job is to anchor ESPN but to watch the event? But you definitely got the idea. These guys still aren't necessarily immersing themselves in what is going to be required for them to do their jobs. They need to know about this. And I mean, I haven't gotten the sense from what I have watched of ESPN that many of the guys were doing a lot of catch-up work and renting DVDs or buying, you know, looking at footage. And then after the Rogan interview last night on SportsCenter, one of the guys goes, "I can't believe we just had the Fear Factor guy on SportsCenter." It's like, if you're ESPN, to your audience, he's not the Fear Factor guy, he's not the news radio guy, he's not the stand-up comedian guy. Joe Rogan, for 10 years, has become the UFC guy.
Right.
And Fear Factor was a side job. So
right,
it makes ESPN look out of touch when they see him as something that's non-sports oriented, when a UFC fan who watches ESPN rolls their eyes and goes, "What do you mean? He's a credible UFC color commentator. Not everybody likes him in MMA, but he's absolutely a good spokesman and an enthusiastic spokesman and knows a lot about it, and I think he brings credibility to it."
I'm not sure. I think it made them look silly because, you know, for every other sport that they do, you know, every other niche sport, you could say even the big sports, hockey, baseball, football, they had their specialists that they bring in to talk about those things.
Yep.
You know, they don't leave it up to the anchor to know everything. But for mixed martial arts, they start covering it this week. Where's their specialist?
Yeah.
You know, where's the person that knows mixed martial arts?
Who is that person? I mean, who is it? Is it Greg Savage, a sure dog? Is it Wade Keller? I mean, who's that person? You know, there's somebody out there. There's people out there. I'm not saying there are people out there. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I'm saying.
Well, it should have been somebody from SureDog. I mean, they've got a website alliance with them. They didn't start their ESPN.com didn't start their own section. They just piggybacked onto SureDog. They should have found someone who's camera friendly and articulate on SureDog, and brought them into the ESPN studio this weekend. It was a big weekend, and it absolutely should have been them or Dave Meltzer. I mean, somebody who knows.
Exactly. Because there was no competition. I mean, I think there was an NBA game last night.
Yep, Jazz Spurs.
Yeah. Right, and then there's Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
Well, that was it. I mean, the Stanley Cup Finals don't start until tomorrow night, which that's niche anyway.
Yeah.
I'm a hockey fan, and I understand that.
Yep.
I mean, even if you look at ESPN's website, they had that poll up there. I don't know if you guys saw it. Asking what the biggest sport you've been in for this weekend. Yeah,
yep.
And you had, you know, UFC, Indy 500, NBA Conference Finals, Stanley Cup Finals, all that stuff. UFC got the biggest vote at, let's see, if I'm bringing it up right now, it's at 33%.
Wow.
So, you know, and they've got that on their own website, and to me, they just dropped the ball for us in large part on their coverage.
Well, I think this was a wake-up call for ESPN, and I think, I mean, unless they're going to be like you know, just dig their heels into the ground and try to laugh this off as a fad. It's just so stupid. Like when on the ESPN News interview on Friday, and the whole anchor, I don't know his name, I should, but the anchor asked Joe Rogan, some people, yeah, you love when questions start with some people say, you know, but some people say this is a fad, and it's like, who are these people, and are they educated enough to be worth quoting? I mean, because some people, you know, some people say, I don't know, you know, ridiculous things. You know, global warming is fictional, and there's no way man can affect the environment. You know, yes, some people say that, but are those people worth quoting on a news show? Why even bring that up? It's been around for 12 years now, and really preceding that in Japan, as an organized, you know, full-fledged sport. It's evolved. It's been through ups and downs. It did more money on pay-per-view last year, and it's part of a trend. Who are these people who say it's a fad? And even if UFC goes down in popularity, and it turns out 06 and 07 were a peak, which isn't going to happen, but let's say it does, it's still not qualified as a fad because it's still going to make millionaires out of fighters for the next several decades if they continue to go the way they're going and regulate the sport somewhat, you know, where there aren't deaths left and right. It's just, it's pure fighting, or as pure as you can get in a sustainable mainstream way, which is what MMA has evolved into, is too damn entertaining to go away.
Right. I think what surprises me the most, I guess, out of all of that about the coverage or lack thereof, is that it does bring in a ton of revenue, and I would think that alone would be enough to get that, you know, the megalith that is ESPN to start focusing its attention more on MMA. That in itself, I would think, would change minds there. I mean, if you're probably thinking, and I don't know anybody that works at ESPN, obviously, but it would strike me that you don't get there overnight, and it takes time and compliance and conformity to the brand to develop your position. And once you get into a chosen position, I would imagine it's hard to make waves, if you will, into this new, and I, you know, you could still argue, somewhat controversial sport.
But it's great. What's great for UFC is the fact that they overtook boxing, excuse me, they overtook boxing and pro wrestling in pay-per-view numbers without the help of ESPN. And if I'm Dana White, I am so happy, because when ESPN shows up at my pay-per-view, I dictate to them where they go, where they stand, and how much coverage we get them, because we made it despite your lack of interest at a time when had your people recognized what a great sport this is and that it had a chance to emerge. If they had been there earlier, ESPN would be, Dana White and everybody at UFC would be grateful to them. But now they see them as jumping on the bandwagon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got, the way you can look at it is you've got Spike TV that noticed, you know, the UFC. Meanwhile, the ESPN gets a stake in the AFL.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes them look all the more silly.
Yep.
They're covering AFL, which gets, you know, I don't don't know what the viewership is for AFL, but it's nowhere near what the UFC is.
No.
You know, and they're covering this sport more than they cover the UFC. I just, it's just another thing that makes them look silly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to have seen, instead of, some people say it's a fad, how about, all Joe, who do you think are the contenders in line if Rampage wins, and who would be next in line for Chuck if he loses? You know, some...
Exactly.
The answers I want to hear as a UFC fan.
Yeah, that sounds like journalism.
Yeah.
That smacks of journalism. They're not doing journalism. They're doing entertainment.
Yeah.
Which, that's what makes this more baffling. They're doing entertainment. It's the Entertainment Sports Programming Network. They're not doing journalism on those interviews. I suspect that they're trying to drum up a little controversy because of that. It just makes no sense, really, any way you look at it. But on the other hand, you know, you're still getting to see your shows, you know, between Spike, you know, Fox Sports, On Demand, Ion Television, probably even a couple out, but it's out there and it's easily available.
Yeah.
I mean, the big question to me is we've got, the UFC or in MMA in general, it's getting covered on this show. So why are we having a conversation of whether it's mainstream? I mean, shouldn't we be past that at this point?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, and you know, a not much talked about aspect of MMA is how many sizable crowds get drawn in how many dozen states every month across the country where small-time MMA shows take place. I mean, it's completely overtaken independent pro wrestling as the neighborhood show that you go to if you want to experience a national product on a smaller scale in person. They're drawing thousands of people, not just hundreds, with no-name local fighters almost anywhere they go. I mean, there's so many examples of that. And that's an aspect that ESPN, doing journalism, would be covering. They would go out and they would find some of these local shows, and they can cover journalistically. Is it regulated enough? Do they follow the same rules as UFC? I mean, you can get into some of the legit controversies, but you have to accept the fact that it's a legitimate sport to begin with.
Absolutely.
And they're still debating. They're debating a topic that really was settled in the late 90s.
Yep. The winds of change sometimes are slow. I think in the last 7 or 8 months, it's made great strides.
Yeah.
You know, almost strides you really couldn't foresee.
Yeah.
And the way it's going, and certainly with the card that was just put out, I think over the summer. I think over the summer it's going to make this past conversation, last 20 minutes of this conversation, irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, it's not irrelevant in the sense that ESPN looked bad this weekend.
No, that's not what I mean. I mean that by the time we go through two or three more cards, with the numbers that those cards do, the sense of this will be, it'll be more, gosh, ESPN, what fools they are.
I'm very interested to see what the cover of ESPN Magazine and Sports Illustrated and ESPN coverage, what impact that has on Spike TV ratings for the next fight night. Because there's going to be people who don't want to pay. They're not quite ready to pay for UFC yet. But it's harder to track DVD sales and rentals. But as far as the ratings go, how does just the normal best of shows on Spike TV, the Ultimate Fighter series, and then the next fight night, does that get affected? Do people say, you know what, this is mainstream, I'm going to give this a shot for free on Spike?
Yeah, I think because of all this, the UFC, it's in their best interest to really sack some of these free cards.
Yeah.
You know, make them look real good, because that's what makes people want to pay for stuff.
Right.
Yep. I think that, and also the other part is there may be a lot of people that don't want to pay for the card yet, but I bet you most of those people know somebody that is.
Yeah.
And are they going to, will they get exposure that way? And I think that this is kind of the tree branching sort of effect that, you might see it at somebody else's house, and then the next time around, you'll get it yourself, and there might be a couple new people there. And
yeah.
I think that's really how the pay-per-view numbers are going to grow.
And I think it's good for UFC. I think it's good for you to see that they're past Tito Ortiz, Ken Shamrock. I'm kind of surprised Dana White's entertaining, Kurt Angle and even Brock Lesnar as a possibility. It certainly would be a huge, huge thing if they sign either of them or both and they fight each other, because you have a chance to bring in a whole other audience. But I just think, I don't know if you need to mess around. I mean, I just think they got so many good, pure, respectable, went through the system the right way MMA guys that I don't know if you need to do a hotshot gimmicky match like that. And, Kurt Angle's age and his condition, I just don't know if you can put him in 3-4 fights before, have him earn his way to the top. I just don't know if he has that in him. So you're looking at just kind of hot-shotting to the top and doing kind of a gimmicky match, like Hughes Gracie or Tito Shamrock.
Yeah, if it's me, I'm telling Kurt Angle, I'm saying, hey, I'll tell you what, why don't you go to the King of the Cage for a few fights?
Yes.
And then we'll see what happens. And Brock Lesnar, let him stay with K1 for a little while, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, have him fight giant Koreans for a couple of times, you know, or whatever, and see how he does.
Yeah.
If he turns out to be the real deal, which, you know, he may do, by all means, bring him in. But right now, you know, I mean, why bother with the gimmicky stuff? Just go with what's working.
And the last thing you need is Kurt Angle in whatever shape he's in going in there and something bad happening.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I wouldn't want to see Kurt Angle get in there in a full contact MMA battle. If it was grappling or something like that, you know.
Imagine Kurt Angle gets an armbar on a guy, and then gets lifted up and dropped on his head.
And then he doesn't get up.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a disaster waiting to happen. I think, Wade, I'd go along with your original impulse. You're getting the new audiences anyway, right now.
Yep.
The new audience is going to come. I mean, speaking for myself, I am one of those guys. I used to watch pro wrestling. I used to buy the pay-per-views, and now I don't.
Yep.
But I'll line up for a UFC show. I'll line up for the Bulldog show. That audience is going to find its way here one way or another as they, you know, increase their exposure. I don't think you need to put Kurt Angle, and like I say, you bring up Kurt Angle, gah, you don't need your first serious incident in the ring to be a guy that, correct me if I'm wrong, got released because of his medical condition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like showing up in Vegas with $500 spending money if you're Dana White, and you're up, and now you've got $15,000. You just had great run at blackjack, you won on roulette, you won at craps, you're up $15,000, and now you decide to put all $15,000 on green,
right,
on the roulette wheel. I mean, it's yes, you can walk away and have this huge, huge payoff, but there's a good likelihood you're going to lose everything that you gain. Maybe that's overstating it, not a perfect analogy, but the point is there. They're just fine right now. Why risk seeming like, and Dana White made the best argument against it up until the last few weeks, where now he started sounding open to it, so...
Yeah, I mean you just made two new crossover stars last night in Quentin Jackson and Houston Alexander.
Yep, that's what's great about UFC. I mean, and that's what's so frustrating about, you know, for pro wrestling fans watching TNA and trying to, you know, take the New Age Outlaws from the late '90s and try to feature them as if they're relevant act today or even Team 3D. When the fact is USC is showing them how if you promote it right and you simulate the fights, which is obviously what pro wrestling does, they simulate the fights, but if you do so effectively and tell a story, you're guaranteed to have a great match that's not going to end in 2 minutes, and you can create a star like Houston Alexander overnight if you have a TV clearance on Spike TV, and they do. And so at some point, pro wrestling's going to learn from UFC, and the first person in pro wrestling who does is going to make a lot of money because UFC has... so many lessons that they've taught and that can lead to huge money being made in the dramatized version of it.
Yep. Definitely.
All right. Well, any final thoughts on this show? Obviously, I think everybody's in agreement. It was one of the better UFC shows we've seen in a while. I think Dana White can be very happy with the way the matches turned out in terms of their quality and in terms of the finishes of the matches, setting up some intriguing fights in the future.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I don't think the timing could have been any better for this show. It was a great, you know, a really good pay-per-view, coming up at the tail end of a lot of mainstream exposure. And, you know, I think it was just a real coup for the UFC, and they've only got good things lined up from here. So.
Yeah,
I agree. I think, the future is bright for the UFC, and... at this point, anyway, as goes the UFC, so does the face of MMA, at least in North America. And I think they're setting themselves up for just a breakthrough summer with this card. I can't say enough good things. I have to admit that, I'm looking forward to seeing Quentin Jackson, see what he does with the media exposure.
Yeah.
I think that it's going to be a great summer to be an MMA fan.
If UFC, they can't protect Quentin, and obviously they aren't because of the Henderson fight. But if Quentin can win and get a streak going to wins, he could be the guy that UFC has never quite had completely, which is a super charismatic, entertaining interview who can represent the sport well. And, you know,
likable.
Likeable. And, you know, Chuck Liddell, I mean, you guys talked about it. He just doesn't seem like he's all that excited about doing media interviews. And you want the guy who's the centerpiece of the product to be a great promo guy. And,
right.
You know, sometimes the best guys in UFC's various weight divisions are going to be guys who don't speak English or don't speak English very well.
Right.
So that's where Rampage is a great opportunity because he can bring some people in. So, you know, for the sake of UFC, and if you're Dana White, you're hoping he beats Dan Henderson. Now, Dan Henderson isn't exactly a bad guy to have representing you either, but he's not Quentin.
No, he's not 28 years old. You know, technically a minority to bring in, you know, what has been predominantly, you could say, a white sport.
Yeah.
He's got media appeal. He's charismatic. He can fight.
He fights exciting fights, too.
He's an exciting fighter.
Yeah.
You know, he is the antithesis of the Tima theory we throw around. I'm looking forward to see how far Quentin Jackson's reign goes, because I think he is the guy to carry them completely over into the full American mainstream.
And the good news is, even if he loses his next 2-3 fights, he's entertaining enough that the win over Chuck made him a UFC legend, and if all they do is have him be guest color commentator and be a gatekeeper, you know what? That might be a decent role for him for the next 10 years, but hopefully it's more than that.
Yeah, he's 28 years old. I think that, you know, physically speaking, you know, he's got some of his best years in front of him from an MMA standpoint. I can't see him falling down the ladder that fast unless there's some sort of other issue that, you know, crops its head up here. But
as I said on the Countdown show, he had trouble getting motivated to train at certain points in recent years. If being on ESPN, SportsCenter, and I don't want to overplay that because it's not like SportsCenter is the number one show on cable each week. It's not, but there's a certain...
Being on the cover of Sports Illustrated, being on the mainstream talk shows, being essentially an American sports celebrity figure.
Yes, that's motivating, and
that's motivating.
You throw in the paydays that come with UFC on pay-per-view right now, which are seven-figure payoffs for one fight are possible and happening for the top fights. I mean,
and it's been a while since we've really had a galvanizing American combat sports figure in the mainstream media.
Yeah.
I mean, at least in a positive light.
Yeah, I don't get the sense that it's going to come out. And, you know, you never know with people. You don't know people. You don't know celebrities. But I just don't get the sense with Quentin Jackson, he's a high-risk person to end up in some stereotypical celebrity mess.
Right. No, it doesn't strike me that way at all. I think... I would be surprised. I think even if he loses his next fight to Henderson, I think he is young enough that he is, and especially now he's got a taste of it, the taste he's going to get over the next 2 or 3 months.
Yep.
I think that he's going to want it back, and I think he's going to be in the mix for years to come.
Yep.
I thought I heard that he's supposed to fight Henderson in October anyway.
Yeah, it's so hard to even, you know, you think of everything that's going to happen between now and then in your life, and it's like, I don't want to wait that long.
It's the summer. It's Memorial Day weekend. June's around the corner.
Yeah.
Summer flies, at least where I live, and it'll be October. It's almost, you know, it's almost winter here now.
Well, luckily we got a lot of fun weight divisions in UFC to keep us busy in the meantime too. So,
if you look between now and then, you got the 72 card looks fantastic, and it looks like it's going to be a fun card. The 73 card is just going to be out of this world. We'll talk about that until October.
Yep.
Yeah. So you're going to have at least two defenses before then of different weight divisions. And aren't they talking about, aren't Koscheck and St. Pierre supposed to go sometime late summer?
74.
74, 75.
Yeah.
So there is plenty, like you said, you could put together intriguing cards every 2 weeks for the next 4 months.
Yeah.
There'll be plenty to distract us.
And when is Gonzaga Couture?
I knew this too.
But I mean, that's another. I mean, it's like you get wrapped up in the one division when it headlines and there's a big finish, and then another one comes up. But and then you go, oh, it's going to be 6 months before we get to see it again.
I think that's 74 or 75, isn't it?
I would think maybe 75. Well, maybe 74. Anyway,
I think it's one of those.
Yeah,
I think it's 74.
So that's, I mean, again, it's just there's, and now you've got the lightweights thrown in too, as and the. Obviously, the Ultimate Fighter series is going to have the big fight night. So, I mean, it's going to be a busy summer, and there's going to be enough big fights to keep us occupied between title fights in each division.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the one thing that I'm intrigued about over the next few months is how things are going to shake out with Pride. Apparently, they did actually finalize the deal
Yeah.
But I wonder if they're going to just keep bringing the top fighters over to the UFC and kind of leave Pride as kind of a Japanese promotion with the Japanese fighters. Maybe keep the freak show fights going. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, are we going to see guys like Gomi over here and guys like, you know, Shinya Aoki, these guys? And are they going to fight lightweight or welterweight? You know, they had that 163 kind of catchweight division over there that they called lightweight. But where are these guys going to go? That's what I want to see, too.
Well, and I think a lot of the luster has been taken off what would have seemed like an incredible Super Bowl dream card just 6 months ago and certainly 12 months ago because so many of the names have already come over. You know, and
yeah, exactly.
I mean, the glory days. I mean, not that there aren't great fighters in Pride who aren't household names in the U.S., but the household names are almost all here now, especially if Silva comes over, you know, and fights whoever. I mean, and there's a Liddell Silva fight. If it's not a Pride versus UFC type thing, and I don't know, you know, I just UFC is so big right now. I don't know that they need to elevate Pride. I think just stay focused on your one brand and bring in the top fighters. And let Pride be the Japanese name brand and kind of wing it from there. They got the fighters they needed.
Yeah, that's I agree. I mean, at this point, you know, do they plan on... I mean, they can't plan on just bringing over Shogun and Hendo and then leaving Silva and Sokaju and Nogueira over there, you know, in the light heavyweight division.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got to bring those guys over at this point, I think.
Fedor would be the one guy who would be the biggest name to bring over, but you have to have an established heavyweight in UFC... that you would want to, and Randy's got to go through Gonzaga to make that seem like a dream fight.
Yeah. I like Gonzaga. He looks like a heavyweight champion to me. I mean, not that Randy doesn't, but I've watched a couple of his fights over and over again, and he just looks like the guy. And as far as Federer goes, and I think we could probably talk about Federer for hours, the longer he stays out of, I think, the American mainstream, or at least, and again, I'm speaking from the North American perspective here, I think the less relevant he gets, I just...
Well, at least the longer he stays away from big fights.
The longer he stays, I guess fights that test him, I think the more irrelevant the Federer discussion becomes, especially in the face of all of the big names losing.
Well, I tell you what, that's why Rampage winning actually really helped keep the Pride-UFC rivalry, whatever form it's in and whatever's left of it, alive, because it had not been a good stretch for Pride otherwise.
No. But then again, I mean, I thought Jackson's style suited him to fight in the cage anyway.
Yeah. Yep. That's true.
I thought of all the Pride fighters that have come over, he was the one most ready to fight in UFC. I think the most telling thing to me was when he knocked Chuck down last night and he pounced into side control. I think either the first or second shot he threw was a right elbow. Which you can't do in Pride. Right then and there, I mean, I knew this beforehand, but it reaffirmed that Quentin Jackson's a UFC fighter now.
Yeah.
It makes me really interested to see how Shogun's going to do. I would think that his game translates very well to the cage, too.
Yeah.
I just think the guys who have brought over so far who have not fared well are guys that just that just don't adapt well to the UFC rules. I mean, Krokop lost because he got marked up by elbows by Gonzaga.
Yeah.
And that was one reason. The head kick obviously was his highlight reel, but it was set up by being ground and bound for 2 or 3 minutes.
Yep. All right, guys. Thanks very much. Good job. Lot to talk about. It's obviously an exciting time to talk about it, and we can go off on 30-minute tangents and easily right now. There's so much to talk about. So I look forward to your next podcast. Great job on the pregame, the preview podcast, previewing the show. So, anyway, on that note, go ahead and sign us off, Sean. You're the podcast host.
All right, well, Four Weight Killer and Jay Catalane, this is Sean Ennis. Thanks for listening.